Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, the UK becomes the first country to grant approval for the use of a COVID vaccine. The rollout is just days away. Also, the Prime Minister here is urged to more often fight back against Beijing online. And on paper, Australia's COVID recession is over. But on the ground, there's reluctance to call it a comeback just yet.
Not yet, no. We definitely can't see it yet until, and I know that we're having to get used to a new normal, but until we're sort of at the stage where we were in the last financial year, I feel like we're definitely going to be feeling this recession for a while.
Well, the first shots of an approved vaccine for COVID-19 will be given in the United Kingdom next week. It's the first country to officially approve a vaccine, and it's the one developed by Pfizer-BioNTech that's got the nod from the UK regulator. The British Health Secretary Matt Hancock has told the BBC he is thrilled with the news.
What it means for people is that from next week, we'll be able to start rolling this out. We'll start with those who are most vulnerable to coronavirus, and it will. You need two jabs, so 21 days apart. And after that, we will start protecting people as the protection comes with these two jabs.
The British Health Secretary there. Well, our correspondent Samantha Hawley joins me from London. Good news, Sam. How did the UK get to this point?
Well, it is. And this morning the government announced that the independent regulator, the MHRA here in Britain, had approved the vaccine for use. And then, of course, you heard from Matt Hancock straight away out there saying it will be rolled out within days, certainly by the beginning of next week. And he was so positive. He said that by spring of next year, things should really be almost back to normal. So the government really out there on the front foot this morning, letting the people know that the vaccination is here or is very soon or very soon will be here. 800,000 doses, they think, will be available before the end of this year. They'll come from Belgium. They'll be packed in very, very cold, dry ice because we know this vaccine needs freezing below minus 70. We also know that it is 95% effective in all age groups. And you heard Matt Hancock there saying that the most vulnerable will be vaccinated first. That will include, Linda, healthcare workers. They'll be a priority for vaccinations. The UK has 40 million doses on order. That means 20 million people can be vaccinated because, of course, you need two jabs of it 21 days apart.
Now, let's have a little bit, listen to a little bit more of the Health Secretary Matt Hancock on the BBC this morning, making his plea for the British people to get vaccinated.
Don't just listen to me. Listen to the doctors, listen to the nurses, you know, listen to Professor Van Tam, who's the Deputy Chief Medical Officer who's responsible for this programme. You know, as he put it, he phoned up his mum and said, "Mum, if you get the call from the NHS, then go and get vaccinated because that is what can help protect you from this virus."
Matt Hancock there. So, Sam, how keen are Brits to get the vaccine? Is there any sort of gauge of reluctance?
Well, I think that will be the government's next goal, I suppose, is convincing the entire population that this is the right way to go. Of course, there are anti-vaccination groups in the UK. We've seen them on most weekends actually out protesting on the streets of London, but they're only small numbers of people, small groups. But I guess this vaccine has been developed very quickly. It took 10 months from the beginning to this point where the regulator has approved it for use. Now, that is record time. That has never been done before so quickly. And so I think there is a reluctance or a concern among people that it's gone too fast and there's a bit of mistrust. I think we'll see a big campaign now from the government to really convince people that the regulator is right, that the scientists have got it right, and that this is a safe vaccine to take because this is the answer, I guess, or the way out of this crisis. It's the only way out of this crisis, according to the government. And as I said before, Matt Hancock says if it's rolled out and it's rolled out quickly, things could be back to normal by spring. And that's what the government will be working towards.
Now, what about other vaccines? How soon could they be approved? Because there are a number now floating around, aren't there?
Well, there are. Of course, there's also the vaccine that the scientists at Oxford University have also developed that still hasn't received the regulatory approval. And, of course, that is less effective or has been found to be about 75% effective if just in just one jab, but two jabs it seems to be a better result. Again, though, this is all now in the hands of the independent regulators in each country. So the British regulator has moved first, the first in the world to approve the Pfizer BioNTech vaccine. There's other vaccines, but it all has to be approved by these regulators. So in terms of time, I guess it really is in their hands, and that's hard to gauge. But within days, we will see people in the United Kingdom being vaccinated. Now, that is a massive task, as you can imagine. Already, we see in Bristol, for instance, a whole football stadium being turned into a mass vaccination centre. And what will happen now is the military soldiers will really take control of the logistics here. So soldiers will be in charge of the logistics to really get a whole population vaccinated. 800,000 doses to come from Belgium, we think, by the end of the year, maybe more, depending on how many can be produced and how quickly. So a lot of people can be vaccinated before the end of this year. And then, as I said, 20 million, just from this vaccine, 20 million people can be vaccinated. So you can see why the military will need to be involved.
Yeah, thanks very much for that, Sam. Samantha Hawley, our correspondent in London, on that news that the UK will UK residents will start getting an approved vaccine from next week. Well, the current downward spiral in Australia-China relations got a very particular kickstart when the Australian government was outspoken on the need to investigate the origins of the coronavirus. China took that as a slight, while commentators declared an Australian-owned goal because the World Health Organization would have done an investigation anyway, which it is doing. It began last month. And now, amidst the extraordinary tensions that have flared this week, an Australian microbiologist finds himself heading to China as part of that WHO investigation. It's hoped that Professor Dominic Dwyer's work with Chinese scientists will include a visit to Wuhan, where early cases of the virus emerged. The ABC's China correspondent Bill Birtles has been speaking with him. Bill, this is science potentially getting tangled up in some very tense politics, not just between Australia and China, but over China's general perception that it's being blamed for the virus. Will the scientists, like Professor Dwyer, get clear air for their work?
Well, he is quite confident that if the Chinese scientists collaborate with the WHO experts, that they will all be committed as scientists to trying to get to the bottom of the origins of the virus. And he said, look, our work as scientists is separate from that of the politicians on all sides, and so we will try and leave the politics out of this. So he is very hopeful that when they can finally go over this team of 10 who are mainly virologists and microbiologists, when they finally can go over, that they will be able to work quite closely with their Chinese counterparts who are already undertaking investigations, and that they will actually be able to get some sort of tangible answers, which at the very least will help to help with preparation for the next time some sort of pandemic or virus event turns up. But he did say to me today, Linda, that it's not quite clear when exactly the team will be able to head over to China and visit the outbreak city of Wuhan.
I think the access, my understanding, is going to be very good. You know, the Chinese authorities are keen for this to occur. So we're starting off already with our discussions with Chinese authorities, as well as within the team, to work out what questions need to be addressed. There will have to be a visit to Wuhan and other relevant locations, and the logistics of that are really being organised. Obviously, the Chinese have done a vast amount of work in trying to understand what happened. So it's a matter of reviewing what they've done so far as well as experts from around the world in different areas, advising about what other studies might be helpful to understand some of the questions.
There are concerns, obviously, that the longer period of time passes from the initial outbreak, perhaps the more difficult it will be to actually find the and trace the origins. What's your view on that? Has too much time elapsed?
Well, look, that's difficult. I mean, you can look at it two ways. Yes, the time has elapsed, so finding the original animal or the original patient zero might actually be very difficult, if not impossible. By the same token, with a bit of time, you get clarity as the science comes in about the virus and about the immune responses to the virus, about the community spread of the virus. So some answers come with time. I'm positive that we will find answers to a lot of the questions. So whether we get all the answers or to everyone's satisfaction, of course, time will tell.
So are you worried, though, that the politics, which are really hot around this issue, that they may get in the way or they may affect your ability to carry out this?
Oh, look, they may. I mean, I think one won't know the answer to that until we get going with trying to do the work.
What's your take on the theory about the Wuhan wet market? That it's sort of thrown around as a likely scenario. What's your understanding of that?
My understanding is that the Wuhan markets were an amplifier. So it looks as though there were some cases of COVID-19 before the market took off, if you like. And so it may have been that the market wasn't the origin of everything, but because it had a lot of people there and people came in who might have had infection, you know, then it spread out of the market into the community. And it took a couple of weeks for people to realise what was going on. Now, before that market, how long this coronavirus has been around, we don't know. And that's really one of the very important things.
Australian microbiologist Professor Dominic Dwyer speaking with Bill Birtles. Well, in the age of Donald Trump's Twitter account, it's increasingly commonplace for world affairs to be hammered out on social media. This week, the Chinese propaganda image that was shared on Twitter about Australia's armed forces underlined the way social media is being used to dominate diplomacy. So as the Prime Minister takes to one of China's favourite platforms, WeChat, in response, how well is Australia playing the game of digital foreign relations? Here's political reporter Anna Henderson.
Local vino is getting endorsements from politicians all over the world.
Ah, that's a fine Australian wine.
But it's praise with a purpose, part of a social media video featuring politicians from the UK, New Zealand, Germany and the United States calling on constituents to help make up the shortfall as China blocks Australian wine imports.
So this December we are asking you all to join us in standing against Xi Jinping's authoritarian bullying.
And letting the Chinese Communist Party know that we will not be bullied.
Cheers. And also say no bullying from China.
Australia's tanking trade relationship with China was inflamed this week when the social media post by a Chinese Foreign Ministry official was published, referencing allegations of war crimes by Australian soldiers in Afghanistan, detailed in an independent report by Major General Paul Brereton. In the hours after the post, the Prime Minister called a press conference in Canberra to express his outrage and disgust. Overnight on the Chinese social media platform WeChat, Scott Morrison posted a message in Chinese. It says Australia is dealing with the issues raised in last week's war crimes report transparently, the way a democratic and enlightened nation should.
There was a missed opportunity.
Fergus Ryan is an analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. He says Scott Morrison should have taken the WeChat approach in the immediate aftermath of the tweet too.
Discussion of the image being fake is being met with derision on Chinese social media. Chinese social media users are saying it's quite clearly a computer-generated image, and it is representing something that the Brereton inquiry alleges actually did happen.
The Prime Minister initially demanded an apology from the Chinese, which he did not get. He also wanted Twitter to take down the post, claiming it was clear evidence of disinformation.
I don't think it was disinformation. I would categorise it as what the Chinese would call edgeball content, and that's content that
really pushes the boundaries.
Fergus Ryan says he's been calling for years for Australia's political leaders to get active on other Chinese social media platforms.
There's a greater chance for Australian officials to get the Australian government narrative into the bloodstream and into the discussions inside China.
New Zealand has already raised concerns about the propaganda post. Today, the United States Ambassador to Australia, Arthur Culverhouse Jr., released a statement taking aim at China's foreign ministry, also accusing it of disinformation.
The world can only wish that the Chinese Communist Party were to bring the same degree of transparency and accountability to credible reports of atrocities against the Uyghurs in Xinjiang.
And
would do well to follow Australia's example and disclose to the world all it knows about the origin of the COVID-19 virus.
The US State Department's deputy spokesperson tweeted, China's attacks on Australia are coercive diplomacy. France has also described the image as shocking and beneath China. Fergus Ryan says it's increasingly effective for social media to be harnessed by nations trying to push back in a coordinated way.
Liberal democracies around the world start to work together in meaningful ways that can push back against this kind of coercive behaviour that that is coming out of Beijing.
Analyst Fergus Ryan from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Anna Henderson, our reporter there. Well, beyond Australia's complications with China right now, there is the ongoing story of Hong Kong and Beijing's tightening encroachment on its freedoms, which saw vast protests over the past year. That movement has been all but snuffed out since Beijing imposed a draconian national security law on the territory. And today, charged in part under that law and languishing in jail, the leading lights of Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement, Joshua Wong, Agnes Chow and Ivan Lam, have been sentenced, receiving between 7 and 14 months jail each, well short of what was feared. Benedict Rogers is a British human rights campaigner. He's an advisor to the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China and the chief executive of Hong Kong Watch. Speaking to him from London, we talked first about the Australian government's reaction in this week's Twitter row with Beijing.
I have huge admiration for the position that Australia has taken to stand by its values and its freedoms despite this huge pressure. And I think my advice to Australia is I would encourage you to continue to stand firm, because if you give in to this kind of pressure, no matter how tough it is, it sends a signal to China that it can behave like this in the rest of the world. And the Inter-Parliamentary Alliance on China has just today released a video encouraging people to buy Australian wine. And other people have been supporting that campaign as well. And I'll certainly be doing that this month.
On that video calling for the world to drink Australian wine, and thank you very much, I'm sure our winemakers are very pleased with that. But isn't it the sort of gesture that China might see as a slightly nasty spit in their eye, if you like? It could be counterproductive.
I don't think it would be counterproductive. I mean, I think that the regime in China only understands one language, and that's the language of strength and of standing up to them. For too long, the free world has kind of kowtowed to Beijing, and that's why they've been emboldened to behave in this kind of way. And I think if we stand up to them, that could have some effect. But also, hopefully, if enough people do things like buying Australian wine, that will make an economic difference to Australia.
Of course, we're seeing Beijing using its influence in counterproductive ways, from a Western point of view at least, in many places. Hong Kong is a huge one that's been on all our radars, and you've been a very vocal advocate for Hong Kong's freedoms. Is that cause lost, though? I mean, there's really not much left to fight for, is there?
I think it's highly likely we will see more pro-democracy activists jailed in the days and weeks ahead. But I would say the movement, I've no doubt, will continue. It will change. It will be more creative. It will be more underground. It will be stronger outside Hong Kong in exile. If the rest of the world doesn't respond, then Taiwan will be next. And indeed, I think our own freedoms will be next.
What is the condition of the protesters who are currently being held in prison in Hong Kong? Protest leaders like Joshua Wong and Agnes Chow are sitting in jail. What conditions are they being held under?
Well, one of the things that was very shocking about Joshua Wong's case in the last week was, firstly, that he was remanded in custody awaiting sentencing, which didn't usually happen in the past. People were usually released on bail. But also, we heard reports that in detention, he was kept in solitary confinement with bright lights on all night, and that he had to resort to using face masks that are meant to be used to protect against COVID-19 as blindfolds because the lights were so strong that he couldn't sleep at night. And that really amounts to certainly ill treatment.
And yet I note that the Hong Kong Stock Exchange is going gangbusters, to use that term. The Financial Review newspaper here reports that there's enough new company listings in the pipeline for the Hong Kong Stock Exchange to beat last year's $40 billion worth. That's in US dollars. Are you surprised that the goose is still laying the golden egg despite everything that's happened to Hong Kong's freedoms?
I am surprised because I think that the reason investors in the past have trusted Hong Kong is precisely because of its transparency, its rule of law, its autonomy and accountability. And I think as those things are dismantled, I would have thought investor confidence would decline. So this news is certainly surprising, but I would raise a question as to how long it will last.
And the Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam has this week complained that she no longer is able to have bank accounts because of sanctions against her. Can sanctions win back Hong Kong's freedoms?
I think sanctions can certainly have an effect, at the very least in making officials in both the Hong Kong government and the regime in Beijing stop and think and maybe hold back some of the worst excesses that may be to come. Whether they can actually win back Hong Kong's freedoms is a different matter, and I think the road towards winning back Hong Kong's freedoms is going to be long.
Benedict Rogers, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Benedict Rogers from Hong Kong Watch in London. The worst economic crisis to hit the nation since the war is now over, the experts say, but we are still in for a long and bumpy recovery. Figures from the Bureau of Statistics show the economy expanded by 3.3% in the 3 months to September. So technically, the recession is over. But a dive into the data shows that those who kept their jobs during the slump and kept the engines turning did not get a cent more to show for it. Here's business reporter David Taylor.
Richard Neal's after-school cooking classes are now cooking with gas again.
That's right. And so the school program's getting strong, or getting back to strength, and school holiday stuff as well. Extracurricular things are also on the improve as well.
You must be relieved.
I am relieved, yes.
When the COVID crisis hit, kids largely stayed at home and his business suffered a big hit. With case numbers at or near zero and children returning to school, parents are welcoming the after-school education and entertainment Richard's business provides.
Just interest in our program. I think, as I said before, the bones of the business have always been there. It's just a matter of getting back and the getting everyone. And I think people are wanting to spend money again. I think there's more confidence, a little bit more confidence going on.
The latest national accounts show the economy expanded 3.3% in the 3 months to September. The Bureau of Statistics notes that reduced COVID case numbers and an easing of social distancing measures and trading restrictions across most states and territories produced the better-than-expected result. Federal Treasurer Josh Frydenberg is cutting the ribbon on Australia's economic recovery.
Today's national accounts can give Australians cause for optimism and hope. And as the Governor of the Reserve Bank said this morning, we have now turned the corner and a recovery is underway.
Labor says the Treasurer's jumped the gun. Shadow Treasurer Jim Chalmers says the economy is still much smaller today than it was this time last year.
This quarterly GDP number will be cold comfort for a million Australians unemployed. Cold comfort for the 2.4 million Australians who are either looking for work or looking for more hours at work.
The reality is that every Australian will experience this economic recovery in their own way. What we do know, though, is that a big boost in household spending on both goods and services, up almost 9%, is driving the recovery. Spending on services rose 9.8%. That's hotels, cafes and restaurants, health and recreation. In Melbourne's West, small retailers are expressing some quiet confidence. Sarah works at a little business that prints photos on wooden panels.
Oh, it's pretty busy. It's getting really, really busy. I think people really needed to get out, and now is the perfect excuse for it. It's like a lot of customers are really happy to see us back here.
Maria sells jewellery, accessories and children's clothes, and business is back in the black.
Most people are, telling us that because of lockdown, it's a me time. It's time for me now. It's time for me to shop. I need to get something for myself. I'm not worried about Christmas yet.
The blood, sweat and tears of ordinary workers is also behind the guts of this recovery. National Australia Bank's chief economist, Alan Oster, says those in work are burning the candle at both ends and not seeing a penny extra for it.
Yeah, they should have had more wage increases, but everybody knows no one's going to get a wage rise in the current environment when you've got a 7 in front of your unemployment rate.
This is what makes recessions and getting out of them so hard, isn't it, Alan Oster? That you've got to...
It is, yeah. Because people will want to be... If you're an employer, you know, you would like to invest more, you would like to employ more people, but you've got to be convinced that the economy's got enough momentum to make that worthwhile.
Kids Cooking School owner Richard Neal isn't yet convinced the economy, or his business for that matter, is out of the woods.
It's still tentative relief, basically, because, you know, you never know in this environment what can change. As we've seen in other states, things can change quickly.
Richard Neal owns Kids Cooking Academy. He's speaking with our reporter David Taylor. So what's the picture of spending in parts of the country where there's less discretionary cash, like, for example, parts of Western Sydney? Gavin Coote has been in that part of town taking a look.
Marina's just been through the first recession in her lifetime. The 21-year-old retail worker is ordering a milkshake after work at Bella Vista and admits she'd been reluctant to spend her hard-earned cash in recent months.
Yeah, I was a bit worried, like, if I would have lost my job, but I knew, like, I would be OK. Like, me and my boss, we worked through it. Yeah, I was a bit worried for the future, like, I don't know, buying a house and stuff like that. You know, it did hold me back a bit.
Other young Australians hadn't been too panicked by the country's first recession in almost 30 years. These Western Sydney students are out celebrating a friend's birthday and felt comfortable continuing to open their wallets throughout 2020.
I think the moment we got to walk out, it was like, yeah, back into that spending lifestyle, I guess. Yeah.
And even at home, like, the online market opens up and... Yeah. Because it's not cash in hand, your money goes up even faster, I reckon. Yeah.
Analytics firm Alphabetas found spending in lower income suburbs in Western Sydney mostly held up, as residents have less cash for discretionary items and continued to buy essentials. But its data shows spending in wealthier suburbs has bounced back, with people again opening their wallets for indulgences. Even so, Bella Vista party shop owner Elma David isn't celebrating the end of a recession just yet.
No, we definitely can't see it yet until, and I know that we're having to get used to a new normal, but until we're sort of at the stage where we were in the last financial year, I feel like we're definitely going to be feeling this recession for a while. Definitely had people probably a little bit more apprehensive about coming in.
Sonia Parlich has a similar reading of the economy. She owns a company that does interior fit-outs for commercial offices and says activity's far from what it should look like at this time of the year.
With a lot of people not returning back to the office and a lot of uncertainty about the workplace, what does it look like? And especially with the larger companies still with only 20-30% returning back to work, a lot of people are still playing it out. No one's in a rush to fit out their office because they're uncertain as to, you know, what it's going to look like.
Sonia Parlich also chairs the Sydney Hills Business Chamber and points out it's a patchy economic picture for this outer suburban growth area. While overall discretionary spending has been down during the COVID-19 recession, this has been somewhat cushioned by the pipeline of construction work that's continuing to flow.
I think we're fortunate in the sense that I think it's one of the highest dual income, local areas where both partners work.
The climb out of the recession for many might be just as difficult as when you're in the depths of it. Who do you think are going to do the toughest during this period?
Without a doubt, probably hospitality, as we all know. I mean, a lot of the smaller operators obviously have been hurting and still are hurting, and I think a lot of people are happy as we're out here today, you know, happy to, you know, get out there when you can and support them. But, yeah, hospitality without a doubt.
Young retail worker Marina doesn't pay too much attention to the bigger economic picture, but agrees there does feel a long way to go.
Just because of COVID, it's sort of held people back from a lot of things, a lot of job opportunities. Especially kids in school going to uni and stuff, it's not just going to be the same as it was.
Marina is a retail worker in Western Sydney. She was speaking with our reporter, Gavin Coote. And that's PM for this Wednesday. You can find all our stories on the PM webpage. Search ABC PM. Hear us live or later on the ABC Listen app and subscribe to the PM podcast at your favourite podcast app. More current affairs with Sabra Lane and AM in the morning. Then at lunchtime, Naz Campanella brings you the world today. I'm Linda Mottram, back with more PM tomorrow. Good night.